This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello and welcome to this very special occasion of the National Museum, the Battle of the Codes. And I guess Rugby League and Rugby Union have battled each other in terms of the media over the years, but the reality is that they're very close and quite closely aligned. We'll hear from Guy Hansen in just a moment, the curator here at the National Museum, about a special exhibition they've got happening, and it starts on Friday. It is fantastic. We've just had a little bit of a sneak preview, and it is worth having a look at. Let me tell you, Guy will tell you about that in just a moment. We'll also hear from Nick Smith, the spin doctor from the Brumbies, and his counterpart, Ben Pollock from the Canberra Raiders. As you notice, we've separated them quite extensively on the table there, and Guy is going to be the moderator in the middle. But over the last week or so, just thinking about rugby league, and when I first came to Canberra in 1988, it was very much a league town, and everybody was talking about the Canberra Raiders. Then they won the premiership in 1989, and they put green dye in the fountain, and thousands lined the streets from Queanbeyan to Canberra to welcome the team home after they beat Balmain in the grand final in extra time. And rugby union, to a certain extent, was shut out of the picture, as was Australian rules. In fact, rugby union at that time was playing at a very small ground where Ainslie Oval is now. It had the grass just growing through the seats, and it was almost impossible to get into the change room because nobody could find the key, and that was the situation that existed then for rugby union. In fact, when the ACT played New South Wales there, I think it was in about 1992, New South Wales at one stage couldn't get out of the change room because somebody had locked them in. And, of course, there was no running hot water, and that was an indication of just where rugby union was going at that stage. Then in 1996, of course, they decided to start the Super 12, as it was known then, now the Super 14, and the Brumbies came into existence. It happened at the time when a split came in rugby league, of course, with the Super League and the ARL. People became disenchanted with rugby league and decided, well, let's support something else, and they jumped on board the Brumbies. And the rugby league people, especially the Raiders, didn't like it. You had chief executives at the time ring you up wondering where you were, why you weren't at training, how come the Brumbies were getting more media time than the Raiders, and the Brumbies were getting the huge crowds at Canberra Stadium, and you had to explain, well, listen, really, the support at the moment is for the Brumbies. It's not for the Raiders. We're not totally disbanding the Raiders, but the mere fact is that you're getting 22,000 out to Canberra Stadium for the Brumbies and you're getting 7,000 to the Raiders, an indication that possibly the support has really shifted away from the Raiders. The Raiders didn't like it because they'd been the top dog in the town for a number of years. In recent times, things have started to even out a little bit. Brumbies got 15,000 last night to a game against Queensland, and possibly with Gregan and Larkham and Paul, etc., Mortlock, they might have got a few more last year. So it is starting to even out a little bit. The Raiders, with a lot of young players coming through, it's very interesting the way that the dynamics have worked in this town. But I'll tell you more about that as the afternoon progresses. Now, what we're going to do is we'll hear from Nick, Guy and Ben. We'll also allow you to ask some questions at the end and possibly have a debate amongst yourselves, I don't know, and take up some of the things that have been mentioned by Ben and Nick and Guy. But we are going to record your questions, so that's just a bit of a warning if you don't want to find yourself being recorded. Well, possibly best not to ask a question, I guess, or get somebody else to ask it. But also, just on rugby league, another funny thing that just comes to mind is that when rugby union started with the Brumbies in 1996, the leagueies got stuck into the Brumbies because they said they couldn't tackle and the huge score lines, etc. So the Brumbies then hired all these rugby league players, Peter Ryan, etc., to come along and teach them how to tackle. Now the rugby league says that union's too defensive, so who knows what's happening. Anyway, what I'd like to do firstly is call upon Guy Hansen to tell us about the Legends of League exhibition, which opens on Friday here at the National Museum.
Well, thank you very much, Tim. I think I can start by declaring my interest in this debate. I played both codes of football when I was a boy at school and have continued to enjoy both of them. I suppose spending the last 18 months working on this exhibition has given me a bit of a tendency to like rugby league right at this particular point in my life. But I do have a great fondness for both codes. And I'm looking forward, and I know amongst my friends and my family, just discussing the centenary often creates debates. people often want to express an opinion as to what is the superior code, and it was really that which led us to the idea of let's have a debate on the clash of the codes, and I suppose that's why we're here today. So, yes, this year, 2008, is the centenary of rugby league. Rugby league actually got going in 1907. The New South Wales Rugby Football League was formed in August 1907, but the first full season of rugby league was 1908, and that's why there is a centenary this year. And the Australian Rugby League, the National Rugby League, New South Wales Rugby League have cooperated with the National Museum to present a centenary exhibition, and they've opened their doors to us, and we've been able to get some wonderful football treasures out and on display. And as Tim mentioned, that exhibition opens next Friday, and there's a big Canberra Raiders fan day next Saturday, and it will run through until May. So I think it'll be a fantastic exhibition, and it does celebrate a major anniversary in Australian life and sporting culture. Whatever side of the debate you fall on, you can't help but agree that rugby league's been a very major part of Australian life over the last 100 years, particularly in Queensland and New South Wales. Okay, so this is the League of Legends logo, which we developed for the exhibition. And I know most people will know who's up there, but just in case, Dally Messenger is on the right-hand side, and your left-hand side, and Darren Lockyer is on the right-hand side. So the symbolism there is the first star of rugby league and perhaps the current Australian captain and star of rugby league today. So that spans the 100 years, connected by the V of the Australian, of the Kangaroos jersey. So how did rugby league get started? Well, it was a New Zealander who really triggered events here. There was a professional New Zealand team who were travelling over to play against the new professional code in England, which was called the Northern Union. At that stage, they hadn't taken up the term league. And they, in England in the 1890s, the Northern Union had begun. They'd reduced the number of players from 15 to 13. They'd started some of the rule changes which differentiated the new code. But the big difference was the players in the Northern Union were actually paid. And this young man, who was a postal clerk in New Zealand, decided to take a professional rugby side over to play the Northern Union and make a bit of money along the way. And, of course, if they're travelling over to the UK, they decided to stop in Sydney on the way, and they wanted to play a team in Sydney. And so there was already considerable disaffection in Sydney amongst some rugby union players, but they weren't compensated for their time. They didn't receive medical insurance, particularly for players who relied on income to survive, if they received a bad injury, their family could be in a very bad way. So there was some disaffection amongst rugby union players who wanted more compensation, wanted medical insurance. And there was also another strong side of the debate, which was that the code should remain amateur at all costs. And it was all about the spirit of the game and the amateurism. And those two forces were at work in Sydney in 1907. But the arrival of these professional New Zealanders created an opportunity for some money to be made, and a group of rugby union players and officials got together and created the new organisation, which was called the New South Wales Rugby Football League. That's actually a poster of the New Zealand side who went on to play in England, and we know the New Zealand side as the All Blacks. This particular side, because it was a professional side and was playing for Coin of the Realm, were nicknamed the All Golds. And they were the team which came through Sydney, and they played some matches in Sydney in August 1907. And interestingly enough, the rule book had not yet arrived from England as to how the new code should be played. And as a result, the first rugby league matches played in Sydney were actually played under rugby union rules. The founders, or the key men in the founding of the New South Wales Rugby Football League, was J.J. Giltinan, who was a sort of an entrepreneur, a man greatly interested in sport, not only in football. He later went on to have a big role in establishing 18-foot yacht racing in Sydney as well. So he was quite a sporting entrepreneur. A cricketer played a big role, Victor Trumper. He was another leading sporting figure in Sydney who threw his weight behind the establishment of rugby league. and a politician, Henry Hoyle, who was a Labor politician involved with the trade union. So you see an interesting alliance here between Labor politics and rugby league, and I think perhaps the beginning of the idea of rugby league as the working class game, and clearly that impetus there where players wanted to be paid, wanted to be compensated, was part of the reason why rugby league was very popular amongst working people who perhaps didn't have the income to just play the game just for the sake of it. And this was this controversy, this clash between amateurism and professionalism, hit other sports as well, such as rowing, a range of other sports as well in Sydney at the time. It was a big debate within the community. How did rugby league succeed? One of the key moments for rugby league was the recruitment of the star New South Wales rugby union player, Dally Messenger. And he was the up-and-coming star in rugby union. He had a capacity to pull a crowd in his own right. If they knew Messenger was playing, more people would come. So once rugby league managed to persuade Messenger to sign up, that helped ensure their success. This is actually from an object from the exhibition. This is a shield which ended up with Dally Messenger. It's the RAS Challenge Shield. It was the first shield of New South Wales Rugby League competition, first grade competition. And after Eastern Suburbs had won it three times in a row, the shield was presented to Eastern Suburbs, who then gave it to Dally Messenger, their star player. And eventually the museum purchased the shield from the descendants of Dally Messenger. And that's one of the icons in our collection. And in addition to Messenger, another part of the story which I think in popular memory is forgotten is the role that the Wallabies played in promoting rugby league. And that in 1908, there was a very successful Wallaby side who went to England and played in the Olympics and actually won the gold medal. They played against Cornwall, interestingly enough, in the Olympics. This is a photo of the match. And that side, upon their return to Australia, were persuaded to play the Kangaroos, because the Kangaroos had also just returned from England as well. So there was a series of very successful matches held in 1909 in Sydney, which were played between the Wallabies and the Kangaroos. It goes to show you how close the codes were that they could actually meet on the football field at this time. And all of those Wallabies went on to join rugby league, all those 1908-1909 Wallabies. And that was a massive injection of star power and also player power to rugby league. And by 1910-1911, rugby league had transformed itself from this struggling breakaway rebel code into being a real force in Sydney. And it wasn't long, and it had completely begun to dominate Sydney rugby football supporters, and also had grown in Queensland and Newcastle and other parts of Australia. And that's a very quick thumbnail sketch of the early history of rugby league. And I think the most important thing to remember is the two codes were very close when they started, obviously branches of the same tree. And perhaps the thing which has made them grow in different directions is that rugby league, very early on in adopting a professional ethos, needed to ensure they had large numbers of people come to see the game. And that began a process of rule changes, which were often about making rugby league a spectacle, a more enjoyable spectacle. And I think that's something we've seen over the last 100 years. Rugby league has aggressively changed its rules right throughout its history in order to provide a better spectacle. A lot of experimentation, the unlimited tackle rule, the four tackle rule, the six tackle rule, the 5-yard rule, the 3-yard rule, a whole series of rules over time to try and make the game more attractive for the fans. And that might be one of the key differences between the codes, which we can explore later on today. So on that, I'll throw it over to our fellow talkers today.
Thanks, Guy. One of the things that I've noticed in the exhibition that we've just seen, it is worth having a look at. I'll just get the details here, but what it is, in the 1930s, there was this player who was playing rugby league in Sydney, and every time he scored a try, he combed his hair, and they've actually got the comb that he used to put into his sock. So I don't know where they got that from. But anyway, there's Frank Hyde's card table there, the original card table where Frank Hyde used to call games from the sideline. And let me tell you, I used to call games from the sideline in Group 11 out in Dubbo, and it's very hard when you've got a pitch that goes sloping on the other side. You can't see over the other side of the field, and often the ball gets kicked towards you and whatever, and things blow everywhere. But anyway, they've got Frank Hyde's card table, headphones used by Frank Hyde, his seat, his binoculars, and also they've got the ball used in the 1989 grand final. And interestingly enough, it is a leather ball and just totally different than the balls they use today. So it really is having a worth look at. And also they've got the Goodwill Cup there, which I have read about in the past, which a lot of people have described as the most over-the-top trophy in the history of sport. And when you see it, you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about. They couldn't have put any more intricacies on this trophy than they have. It's just totally over the top. And also they've got the Winfield Cup, which Laurie Daly dropped on the way from Queanbeyan to Canberra in 1989 before it was hastily repatched and taken to the lodge that night and celebrated in front of Bob Hawke when the Raiders won the grand final. But that was a magic moment. Now, the two people that we've got to talk today, extolling the virtues of rugby union and rugby league, I think it was in 1997 when Super League came into being. One of the rules of Super League clubs was that every club had to have a media operator so that when journalists phoned the coaches, as they'd done in the past, the coaches wouldn't tell them anything. I mean, classic cases many times with the Raiders, you'd ring Tim Sheens up and you'd say, "Oh, Tim, a bloke came off with a broken leg," and Tim would say, "I'll be right next week," only to find out that he's out for two seasons. But the role of the media operator or the PR person with the club now is to make sure that the media gets the correct information. And for instance, Nick, at the moment, Julian Huxley was knocked out last night. We'd call it concussion, but Laurie Fisher very keen on calling it a head knock, because if you call it concussion, apparently he's got to be out for 3 weeks. But if it's a head knock, I mean, the bloke was convulsing on the ground, but apparently if you call it a head knock, he only has to miss one game. So Nick's job this week will be to ensure that the media says that Julian Huxley suffered a head knock and not severe concussion. Anyway, our first speaker to extol the virtues of rugby union is Nick Smith.
Thank you very much, Tim. And I'd like to thank the National Museum for this opportunity to come and speak today in this clash of the codes. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be putting forward the case for the magnificent code of rugby union today, and I've agreed to speak very slowly and, where possible, in single syllables for my league counterpart, Ben. In the lead-up to this debate, I've had a number of panicked phone calls from Ben asking, nay, pleading with me to change sides so that he could debate in favour of rugby union. However, after convincing him that I didn't think it was in his best career interests to publicly concede that rugby union was a far superior sport, and after several minutes of explaining to Ben that debate wasn't something that you put on the end of the hook when you went fishing, he finally came around. But it's all right. I see he's got a number of picture cards with him today, and I'm sure he'll put together a very convincing argument. Well, we're here to celebrate the centenary of rugby league, and I must admit that rugby union had a fantastic centenary when we celebrated it more than 85 years ago, but I guess that's neither here nor there today. But before I get too involved, I'd like to congratulate rugby league, which is commonly regarded as rugby union's little sister, on reaching 100 years. Now, there are many cynics who thought that it would never survive a century, but rugby league, which is now developed into a nice little suburban park game, is now flourishing in Manchester, Port Moresby, Pukekohe and Ingleburn, has certainly proven them wrong. Now, for those who don't know, rugby league in Australia, as Guy mentioned, was founded in a little sports shop in Market Street in Sydney by J.J. Gilton and Victor Trumper. Now, I'll let you in on a little Smith family secret here, that Victor Trumper was actually my great-great-uncle on my father's side. That's a true story. Now, while he was credited with being a great bloke and an even better cricketer, my relatives have had to carry around the emotional baggage and family shame that he was directly responsible for bringing rugby league into this country. That's right, this legend of Australian cricket was responsible for introducing this weed that has infested the sporting landscape of this otherwise unblemished country. Now, today, I'll be taking more of a holistic approach in telling you, of course, what you already know, that rugby union is far superior to rugby league. And I've chosen to focus on three of the thousands of aspects that illustrate this extremely well-known fact. First of all, that rugby union is a better preparation for life, that rugby union is a passport to the world, and that the quality of the actual sport of rugby union is vastly superior to that of its little sister. Now, it's a simple and undisputed fact that rugby union is the definitive gentleman's game. It teaches the importance of vision, perseverance, tenacity, camaraderie, and working within the rules. And once you've been inducted into the rugby community, you're a member for life. While rugby league is driven by more sinister and mercenary ideals, rugby union is internationally united by a common set of values: teamwork, pride, respect, and mateship. These are the values that not only define the sport, but can be employed in life after rugby. Rugby union abides by the motto of "what happens on the field stays on the field." After each match, players universally join in the bar to enjoy the brotherhood and community of rugby, sharing happy times and revelling in the friendliest game on earth. Unfortunately, league's counterphrase of "what happens on the field can usually be sorted out in the car park" doesn't lend itself to the same jovial culture. This mentality was perfectly demonstrated with Wally Lewis and Mark Geyer and their spat after the whistle had blown in the 1991 State of Origin. Now, while rugby union is totally dedicated to upholding their fine values and welfare to the sport, it's also committed to the welfare of their players. Rugby union is served by some of the most active players' unions around the world. In Australia, the Rugby Union Players Association is bound by unanimity and provides a united front on behalf of the playing group. Alas, rugby league is a game of individuals driven by self-interest. The Super League ordeal was a perfect example of this egocentric nature and resulted in the self-destruction and self-cannibalisation of the sport. When rugby was presented with professionalism and a similar challenge in 1995, rather than divide and be conquered, the players took one voice, thus leaving the game intact and allowing the sport to evolve into an even faster, sexier, and increasingly global entertainment spectacle. This involvement with the various national players' associations around the globe has also ensured that players have fulfilling careers mapped out for when their playing days draw to an end. In fact, a 2007 Sweeney Sports poll showed that not only do 87% of all rugby union players go on to tertiary education, but 95% of rugby league players own a PlayStation, which is up on the national average of 22% of all Australian homes that own computer gaming consoles. Now, some of the former rugby union players that have gone on to fulfilling and high-profile careers include former All Blacks captain David Kirk, who is the current chief executive of Fairfax Media, former Grand Slam-winning Wallaby Michael Hawker, who is the CEO of the Insurance Australia Group, Dr. Brett Robinson, who of course was the foundation captain of the Brumbies, is now the general manager of the Insurance Australia Group, and Peter Fitzsimons, former Wallaby, is one of this country's most read journalists and authors. In fact, the 2006 Who's Who of Australian business includes more than 150 former rugby union players from the elite level. There are only six former Australian rugby league players listed in that book, two of whom I believe are being investigated for embezzlement and tax fraud. What's more, you can only expect this number of former rugby union players in these sort of publications to increase, with individuals like Joe Roth, currently studying at Oxford University, and current Brumbies squad member Daniel Guinness recently receiving a Rhodes Scholarship. The final point I'd like to make in regards to rugby's superior preparation for life is that it's a sport that encourages participation. Regardless of one's body shape, rugby union has a position for you. Unlike rugby league, which supports elitism, rugby union promotes inclusion, which I think you'll agree is another one of life's very important little lessons. To illustrate this, I've taken an average of each of the common positions between rugby league and rugby union in the Super 14 tournament and the National Rugby League. Now, in the Super 14, the average prop weighs 126 kilos. The average back rower weighs 110 kilos. Scrum half, 87 kilos. Winger, 92 kilos, and a centre, 99 kilos. In rugby league, the average prop weighs 94 kilos. The average back rower weighs 94 kilos. A halfback weighs 93 kilos. Centre, 94 kilos. Winger, 94 kilos. Now, if variety is indeed the spice of life, then rugby league is a very stale game, and I think those numbers clearly speak for themselves. The bottom line is to compare the glorious code of rugby to rugby league is like comparing a five-course cordon bleu banquet cooked by a five-star Michelin chef with a stale packet of Vita Wheats. Now, as far as passport to the world goes, rugby union is a truly global sport. A rugby union tour can take you to the elegance of the Eiffel Tower in France, or the beauty of Buckingham Palace in England, or even the splendour of Japan's Mount Fuji. In a rugby union, players are treated to the architectural and engineering marvels that are Twickenham, Millennium Stadium, which of course is the former Cardiff Arms Park, the Stade de France, Murrayfield in Edinburgh, Ellis Park in Johannesburg. All these modern coliseums have been built as contemporary temples to the game they play in heaven. What about rugby league? Well, I've heard that the pokey lounge at the Penrith Leagues Club is supposed to be quite breathtaking, and I'm yet to receive a postcard, but I've heard that the beer garden at Brisbane's Caxton Hotel is supposed to be quite good. And if you're lucky, you'll get to play a match on the hallowed turf of the Campbelltown Sports Club, Sports Ground, or even Redfern Oval. Ladies and gentlemen, to suggest there is even a comparison between these two codes is completely absurd. While we're discussing the ability of rugby as a portal to the world, it would be remiss of me not to mention the Rugby World Cup. Now, I can fully appreciate that Ben is probably shifting uneasily in his seat at the moment as he realises that his game has absolutely no answer to the third largest global sporting event. But before I go on, I'd just like to take a second and ask everyone to remember their favourite moment from the last Rugby League World Cup. No? OK, well, why don't you just take a moment to reflect on any moment from a Rugby League World Cup? Can anyone actually remember anything from any Rugby League World Cup? No? Well, for those of you who are unaware, the last Rugby League World Cup was actually held in the year 2000, but don't beat yourself up over it. They're not even a regular event. Some of the highlights of that World Cup included Lebanon's epic 104-0 win over Morocco, the United States' 68-0 win over Canada, and who could ever forget the Welsh Rugby League's emotional 38-6 win over the Cook Islands. Just so you know, the Welsh had a terrific World Cup that year, making the semi-finals. Now, something else that you probably should know is that rugby league doesn't even figure in the top 10 sports of Wales. Naturally, rugby union is regarded as its national sport. Then comes soccer and cricket, and even darts gets a mention. Now, I don't know if your alarm bells are ringing, Ben, but when one of rugby league's poster countries would rather go and watch someone throw triple 20 than go and watch one of their national players score a try, then I think it speaks volumes for the international appeal of your code. Now, while we're speaking of people watching an international appeal, perhaps we should cross-check the attendance records for the last Rugby World Cup against the last Rugby League World Cup. Both were held in France and the United Kingdom. The 2007 Rugby World Cup averaged in excess of 47,000 people per match, with more than 2.5 million people passing through the turnstiles over their 48 matches. The 2000 Rugby League World Cup had an average attendance of just under 8,000, attracting almost 250,000 to their 31 games. Now, I'm no mathematician, but it does seem to be a bit of a disparity there. And no matter what anyone states about these two codes, this figure alone is a game, set and match for rugby. Let's be honest, even as a national game, rugby league struggles. Whatever happened to the Western Reds? Where are the Hunter Mariners now? And does anyone remember the Adelaide Rams? But before you rubbish the idea of a rugby code being able to survive out of Brisbane, Sydney, or west of the Great Dividing Range, I'd like to remind you that the Adelaide Sevens are now an established part of the South Australian sporting calendar and brought almost $20 million to the local economy in its first year. And the Western Force are doing extremely well with a membership of 32,000 people. That's four Rugby League World Cup crowds for your benefit, Ben. Now, there's simply no question that rugby union is a far greater sport. It's a more stimulating contest than its little sister. Rugby league is predictable. It's a lesson in mediocre repetition. It's about hitting it up for one tackle, hitting it up for another tackle, hitting it up for another tackle, and on the fifth tackle, they kick. Just as an aside, during my research, I found out that they introduced the four-tackle rule in 1966 because players were having difficulty trying to count unlimited tackles on their fingers. But as I was saying, rugby league is not about running into space. It's about running into people. It's a mindless 80-minute demolition derby that is painfully devoid of any of the thought or tact of rugby. It still pains me that there are actually spectators who still go to this sport knowing exactly what's going to happen. Then there's the greatest joke in international sport, the rugby league scrum. I've never seen a more pathetic display than what these contests have degenerated into. In rugby union, unpredictability, in addition to being a mouthful, is the only certainty. Possession is constantly up for grabs, with even more contest and more excitement generated through the introduction of the new ELVs. The sport thrives on the use of deception to create space and to set free athletic ball runners. It's a thinking man's game full of elaborate tactics, skills, and athleticism. In the last 7 years, rugby league's top players have cross-coached, each citing the need for a challenge as their reason for converting. Wendell Saylor, Lottie Takiri, Clinton Schafoski, and Tamana Tahu are but a few who have acted on their epiphany and jump from the sinking ship to finally understand the finer and tactical side of contact football. Simply put, rugby league is a game for boofheads. We don't expect the rugby league fraternity to understand every rule and law of our wonderful sport, and to be honest, the beauty of rugby is in its complexity, and it's not a game for simpletons. Rugby can be enjoyed at all levels, from the casual spectator who enjoys watching tackles being made and tries being scored, through to the ardent supporter who thrives on the angles of a scrum engagement, the effectiveness of each clean-out, or the success of each running line. Put simply, each rugby union contest is a riveting, breathtaking, physical drama of Shakespearean proportions. Now, no doubt Ben's rebuttal will be as predictable as the pastime he's here to defend. He'll get up here and make backless claims that rugby players can't tackle, that the sport is for leather patch wearing toffs, and that he can't understand any of the rules. Sorry, Ben, am I taking all your material here? He will get up here and he will quote people out of context, and he may even make up a few facts and figures in the absence of any substance to his argument. He will get up here and try to persuade you of his wafer-thin case by throwing out the exhausted and hackneyed anomaly that league is the greatest game on earth. Greatest game of all. Unfortunately, that is nothing more than a bumper sticker line and a pitiful statement for a sport that 99% of the world doesn't even know exists. It's embarrassing that a suburban pastime like rugby league can make such a pathetic claim when their entire sport can only aspire to be as remotely professional as rugby, despite paying players from the outset, and the pinnacle of their game could only dream to be as internationally renowned as the Rugby World Cup. State of Origin is the highest level of rugby league, always has been, always will be. How then can you have such an absurd game where achieving for your club or state is more important than representing your country? Test football, if you can call it that in rugby league, is an irrelevance and an embarrassment. Now, I admit there are thousands of points that I've been forced to omit for fear of completely ruining this celebration for rugby league. And, as I said initially, let's give league some credit. For the suburban pastime that it is, it's done extremely well. It's just unfortunate that it will never stack up to the grandeur and magnificence of rugby union at any level, whether it be the contest itself or any of the values or benefits surrounding the game. Rugby union is unquestionably a better sport with international appeal and an ideal preparation for life. And if it is indeed the game they play in heaven, then it would seem it's a better preparation for the afterlife as well. My message to all the leaguies, congratulations on 100 years, but make the switch while you still can and avoid an eternity in sporting purgatory. Now, I apologise that this discussion, while it was meant to be a debate, will be a very one-sided affair and simply confirmation of what you and millions of others already know, that rugby union is a far greater sport than the suburban pastime of rugby league.
Might have to extend the room booking. It says here 7 minutes, not 7 hours. But anyway, well done. Well done, Nick. Son of Brian, of course, brother of Jason Smith and Tim Smith. You had a bit of a laugh there. It was good, yeah, talking about the great highlights from the last World Cup in rugby union. Plenty there. 2007 in France. And also the mateship in rugby union. I just got this mental image of Matt Henjak and Haig Saar in a Fremantle hotel, getting on superbly. Sam Norton Knight, Lottie Takiri on the field last year. Oof. That's mateship for you. Ben Pollock from the Canberra Raiders.
One word to sum that up, Nick. Predictable. Of course, you come out and you're based your argument on the elitism of rugby union and all that it can provide for the afterlife, which absolutely has no bearing on the fact that it is a rubbish sport and it's not fun to watch. And that's probably the most catalytic point I could bring forward today. You mentioned the World Cup. I forgot about how good the matches were that involved Namibia, Japan and Tonga during that. Fantastic matches, not lopsided at all. You mentioned preparation for life after football. If you'd taken any notice in what's happening in rugby league this year, they're actually making it compulsory for all their under-20s players to focus on career, and they can't train during the day hours, so that's something there. You mentioned the car park stoush, and Tim alluded to Matt Henjak. Yeah, fantastic ambassador for rugby union there. And, of course, the Western Force, who don't just pick on each other, they also pick on our native animals, the poor little quokkas. You mentioned that rugby league players are all 94, 95 kilograms and thus it's not a game for everyone. Well, I turn you to the magnificent ambassador for youth and childhood obesity, Matt Dunning. Fantastic role model for youth there he is. And, of course, your beloved ACT Brumbies, which, of course, are no longer the ACT Brumbies. They're just the Brumbies. Why they dropped that off there, I'll never know. But let's talk a bit about rugby league versus rugby union and what it really is and the fundamentals of the sports. Let's look at rugby league first. It's more exciting, more tries, bigger hits, bigger crowds, a bigger spectacle of sport. Rugby union, as I like to call it. It has more whistles than a sheepdog trial. You need a degree in law to understand the rules. And it's about as exciting as watching John Howard on one of his morning walks. Scoring in rugby league. 4 points for a try, 2 points for a goal, 1 point for a field goal. In rugby union, you almost get as many points for kicking a goal and for kicking a field goal. And I know that one of my favourite parts of rugby union is going to watch this.
For 40 minutes out of 80.
It's really exciting stuff. You mentioned the rules and, of course, the complexity of rugby union and how you alluded to being a more complex, intellectually based sport. Well, sure, rugby league is simple. You may kick off. You've got six tackles to get down the other end and score a try. You score a try, you kick a goal. You come back. It's fought out. It's tough. It's physical. Then you've got rugby union. Now, just to understand a little bit more about the game, like, I decided to just go through the rules and I found on the website the laws of rugby union 182 pages of drivel. I'll read you a couple of my favourites. This is the... Imagine explaining this to a 120-kilo tight-head prop. When a teammate of an offside player has kicked ahead, the offside is considered to be taking part in the game if the player is in front of an imaginary line across the field, which is 10 metres from the opponent waiting to play the ball, or from where the ball lands or may land. The offside player must immediately move behind the imaginary 10-metre line. While moving away, the player may not obstruct an opponent. Now, I know footballers from both codes, and they're not a smart bunch, and I'll admit that. But I can't see some of your big boys understanding some of the complexities that goes along with that. One of my other favourites was the tackle. Rule 15.1. Where can a tackle take place? A tackle can only take place in the field of play. I'm glad they put that one in there. And it goes on for pages and pages. All players forming, joining and taking part in a ruck must have their heads and shoulders no lower than their hips. Now, I don't know if Gandhi's been playing rugby union, but...
Does that mean that's not allowed?
And it does. It seriously, I won't bore you with it because it is actually quite... That's rugby union, though. Now, apart from the rules, we look at the sport these days and rugby union turned professional... back at the start of the Super Rugby season, I suppose you call it. And what with it come commercial factors, sponsorship. You've got TV ratings. And TV ratings is a huge part of sport in Australia. And I'd just like to go through a... I just managed to come across the TV ratings in 2005 for the official ratings weeks, which is week 7 to 48 of the year. And if we have a look at there, we've got... Number 4 on the all-time of the year's programming was the Rugby League Grand Final. 17th was the pre-match entertainment of the Rugby League. 21st was State of Origin of Game 3. 28th was State of Origin Game 2. 29th was State of Origin Game 1. And this goes on. In regional Australia, the heartland of the nation, the top 4 programs were Rugby League, the Grand Final, the 3 Origins. And it goes through all the way. Now, just searching on this list... For a rugby union match, no, we've got the Happy Days 30th anniversary reunion coming in at number 37. And we've got the Big Brothers letting the intruders into the house at number 40. But there's no rugby union match. Now, you may say, that's fine because most of our matches are played on pay TV. Well, I also had the pay TV stats. 39 out of the 40 match of the top rating TV shows on pay TV were rugby league matches, which just goes to show... that nobody really cares, mate. Now, you mentioned player poaching. You didn't mention player poaching. That's what I'll call it. You called it seeing the light. Rugby unions has this sick fetish with chasing rugby league players. Wendell Saylor, Lottie Takiri, Matt Rogers, Clinton Chavosky, Tamana Tahu. It's all payback for trying to get back at when we took Dally Messenger, your greatest ever player. And I suppose Matt Rogers came out and said that it was great to be back in rugby league because he could score a try again. And I can see where he's coming from because where tries are very far and few between in rugby union. Now, you mentioned the State of Origin being the pinnacle of rugby league, and to be truthful, it is. It's New South Wales versus Queensland, state versus state, mate versus mate, the cane toads versus the cockroaches, fantastic spectacle, huge audiences, both at the games and on the TV. Then you look at the equivalent in rugby union, the magnificent clash that is the Waratahs versus the Reds, two highly recognisable sides there, with the Waratahs unleashing the most ordinary mascot in world sport, otherwise known as Tarman earlier in the week, invoking a lot of passion there. Probably my favourite part of the rugby union fraternity in the last few years was the ARC, or the Australian Rugby Championships. This was the ARU's attempt to try to make rugby union, the national sport. They probably should have named it the Football Australian Rugby Union Enterprise, otherwise known as the FARS, because that's exactly what it was. For a starter, how are you going to get grown men and their families to go out and support teams with names like the Central Coast Rays, the East Coast Aces, the Perth Spirit, and the Sydney Fleet? Now, I can just picture a few of you boys at the back waving your Sydney Fleet flags on a Saturday afternoon. I'm sure it'll be very exciting for you. Now, TV for the ARC, the ARU actually had to pay the ABC to get this thing on TV. There was no fight for TV rights, no big clash of the networks. The ARU actually had to put their hand in their back pocket and pay for it. As opposed to this year in the NRL, we had the new Toyota Cup competition, under 20s, Fox Sports will be showing two live games each week, which they have paid the rights for. Now, the ARC cost, after the 2007, around $2.5 million over budget, and it was forecast in 2008 to be a further $3.5 million over budget. That's around $8 million loss for the ARU, and they canned it because they described it as being fiscally irresponsible, and I agree. Which brings me to the point of leadership between the two sports. The NRL has a great man now by the name of David Gallett, who brought rugby league out of the Super League era, if you like to call it, and turned it into one of the most commercially and prosperous codes in Australia. Now, the ARU's counterpart is John O'Neill, fantastic man also. Took the World Cup ball and run with it after the Rugby Union World Cup. Took the Socceroos through to the World Cup in soccer as well. And a fantastic entrepreneur. And he knows his stuff because he's come out and said after the Rugby World Cup, and this is from your boss, Nick, Rugby League went from unlimited tackles to limited tackles. It went from 3 metres to 5 metres and reduced the value of a field goal to one, he said after arriving back from France. When you say, why did it do that? It did it for some pretty obvious reasons, and we may be confronted with the same reasons. Quite a valid point. Rugby League has been around as a professional game for 100 years. I think there's a lot we can learn from it and some of their lawn changes. We need to create space. We need to create time. We want to create a philosophy that encourages try scoring. That's what people come to see. And I think that the boss of the ARU has hit the nail on the head there by saying that, fair enough, Rugby League actually knows what they're doing. Now, the most important part of any sport is fans. So who here is a Brumbies fan? Raiders fans here today? Yeah, we thought that might be the case. Raiders fans are out having a beer at a pub on the afternoon. They don't come to this. Just kidding. Anyway, the fans, most important. Rugby union fans go to the game to be seen. They don't go to watch the game. They clap when the ball gets kicked out. They wear Wranglers and RM Williams despite probably having never even set foot on a farm. They don't even know the players in their own team, let alone the name of the players in the rest of the code. Rugby league fans are the heart and soul of the nation. They're the working people, the fighters, the little Aussie battlers. They go to see a scrap. They go to see the thrill, the excitement, the agony, the ecstasy of the sport. Players in rugby league, fans in rugby league don't even know their players. They know their players from the last decade. They know the players in all the competitions all around the world. And at the end, they will walk the end of the earth to see their team host a trophy at the end of the season. And ladies and gentlemen, that is why rugby league is better than rugby union.
Yes, rugby league, the game for working families across Australia. let me give you a tip, Ben. Rugby league nicknames aren't all that hot. Storm, the Titans, the Dragons, the Knights. Television ratings as well. Rugby union people are busy people, remember that. Now, what we're going to do is have a little bit of a debate facilitated by me, of course. And what we're going to allow you to do is ask a question to any of the people who have spoken here today. We have a microphone, remembering, of course, that we are recording proceedings. And if you'd like to ask a question, simply put your hand in the air. But I've got one to start with, and it's to you, Nick. You're talking about self-interest with rugby league players. The catch cry now in rugby union appears to be take the money and run to Japan and the UK. A lot of good players are leaving, aren't they?
We are losing a few players at the moment, but obviously they've looked at, as I was saying, the welfare of the sport, and we've got people looking out for their best interests, and they...
Ben, you got an offer here, mate?
Well, sport's a business now, and it's very... it can be very competitive in the markets, and we're seeing the same thing with the Canberra Raiders at the moment, with the situation around Todd Carney. I suppose teams from not only Australia but also from overseas in rugby league in particular are looking to score the best players. And yeah, I can see arguments from both sides on why players should stay or why they should go, but in the end it is a business and sometimes you've just got to live with it.
But they've also got to take into account more than just money as well. Like, obviously, we've just re-signed Sterling Mortlock, something that we're very happy about, and he was being offered ridiculous amounts of money overseas. So I think, as Ben was saying, they've got two things to weigh up, whether it's lifestyle versus money, and let's hopeful that lifestyle and loyalty will keep a lot more of the players in the country.
You blokes are supposed to be arguing each other.
Oh, no, I've still got plenty of points to pick Ben up on, so don't worry about that.
There are a lot of rules in rugby union, aren't they? And last night, I mean, the short-arm penalties that were given by the referee, it was almost at every ruck and breakdown that the bloke had his arm in the air. It's a real problem in rugby union, I think, even though they've decided to speed the game up with the experimental laws and the variations. It is...
Have a read of this. It's great reading. But as I said, Tim, the beauty is in its complexity. And if you want to get really involved, I mean, I know that I and a number of rugby union enthusiasts, really ardent sort of blood, rugby flowing through our blood enthusiasts, keep a copy of those rules by our bed. And every time we travel, we ask them to take the Gideon Bible out of the hotel room and put that in instead. So, yeah, we love our rules. But as I said, it can be enjoyed on a number of various levels. And those who want to come just for the sort of the face value of watching a few tries being scored or a few goals being kicked, then it can appeal to them as well.
And Ben, rugby league is a simple game, not necessarily played by simple people.
It's just a great sport. I mean, people go to be entertained, and you're going to be entertained if you come to a rugby league match. Simple as that.
Should we bring up that state of origin? As I said, that's the pinnacle of the sport, is the state of origin a couple of years ago when the score was 2-0. Yeah.
And that was a hard-fought contest.
Like every rugby union game.
Oh, rugby.
All right, we've got some questions.
I'm actually a left-wing radical feminist who loves my sport, but I'm not a league fan, and I've been to one league game, and I'm sorry, but cheerleaders are not an acceptable part of Australian sport. I love the game itself, I love watching the game, and I really enjoyed going to see the boys play and as a spectacle, but I'm sorry, but the cheerleaders are not a great attitude towards women, and I know that Raiders are taking steps to address the issues of women. And how we can be incorporated other than consumer as a product, but you have to do something about them. And I mean, I love going to the union games, and I love my Brumbies and my Wallabies, and I think women get treated a whole lot better by the AAU. So I just wondered what kind of comments. It's a serious issue, and I know that you're taking some steps, but how can we be incorporated into league as like 50% of the paying public?
Women in sport is an area that rugby league has been targeting now for a few years, and are starting to ramp their efforts up in that. They've conducted a number of, and they will be this year in the centenary year. We're conducting a number of seminars, and there's one in Canberra in I think it may be May, a women in sport seminar. So I invite you to come along to that. There'll be guest speakers of people involved in women involved in rugby league. I know that the Manly Club has a group called the Eagles Angels, which is a fantastic group of high-profile women in Sydney that support the Seagulls. And that's something that we're looking at incorporating on a game-wide sort of basis. And we've got a very strong female fan base. And I can see your point with the cheerleaders. Cheerleaders is always going to be a topical subject when it comes to sport. I think if it's done tastefully, it's not a problem. So... yeah.
Russell Crowe got rid of cheerleaders out of South Sydney.
And Russell Crowe also threw a phone at someone.
I know, but he also has taken a stand against pokies as well, so yep. Making them more family-friendly and women-inclusive
The poker machine issue is a very touchy one. If that particular club that they took the poker machines out wasn't a very financial gain for the club, so it's a little bit of a PR stunt, I suppose. But I understand where you're coming from with the cheerleaders. This year, you'll see, I know particularly with the Raiders, we've assembled a new squad, and the emphasis will be on entertainment rather than just singing and dancing, rather than just dancing and waving pom poms. One of the girls is actually a singer, and she'll be singing at matches this year as well. So
there are steps that we're taking, and
yeah, we had the Navy last night, and it was quite good entertainment. Mm. I mean, and the singer was and the band was great.
Yep.
And we have some really good entertainment, but it doesn't involve women in the way that the league presents us. And I just think that if you want to get people involved and you want more fans at the games, I won't go back to a Raiders game until you've changed your attitude towards women, and that's getting rid of the cheerleaders.
Okay. You know, a couple of years ago I took your point up and I actually took it to the rugby league and I said, listen, you're turning a lot of women away by having cheerleaders. And I aired it, put it on air, and had a debate with the rugby league hierarchy. This was about 7 years ago. And I got a call from one of the cheerleaders, and she took task with me and said that, listen, the only professional dancing gig that we get in Canberra is being a cheerleader at the Canberra Raiders. Otherwise, we've got to go to Sydney if we want to dance.
Yeah, I know,
but I'm just saying to you that it has been taken up in the past, and the cheerleaders themselves have come out and said, listen, if we want to be professional dancers and we want to do this type of display, it's the only place that we can do it in Canberra, which is a little unfortunate. But it is, I agree, it is a bit of a throwback, and there's no doubt about that. If you go to South Africa and watch rugby union, it's even worse. I mean, you've got girls in hot tubs on the halfway line. You've got girls jumping on the ground in bikinis at half time and before the game and after the game. So I'm not condoning it in rugby league, but I'm just saying it does exist elsewhere. It's not just rugby league. But I agree with you, but I'm just saying to you that there is an alternate argument that has been presented by the cheerleaders themselves in terms of wanting to be dancers.
Because women are like health professionals. They're involved in managing all aspects of the health of the team. They're on the board of the NRL. They're involved in the clubs, in the administration, and a whole bunch of really professional ways. Mm. How can you raise the profile of women and the women? Have you thought about doing something to raise the profile? Are we actually included in the exhibition and women who play rugby league?
There is an exhibit of women's rugby league players in the exhibition, and there is also an exhibit of cheerleaders as well of cheerleader costume. And I can assure you, amongst my staff, this issue has been discussed at great length as to whether we should be covering this issue and how to approach cheerleaders. And we did that thing which Tim mentioned, which was we actually talked to cheerleaders and asked what they wanted and what they felt, and exactly the same response was received, that they are professional dancers who see themselves as plying their trade and doing a good job, and they want that celebrated. So that is a perspective which is out there, but we also showcase women who actually play rugby league as well in the exhibition. And, there is a growing women's rugby league in its own right being played in New South Wales and Queensland.
So the suggestion that you just go about cutting up the orange?
No, they're actually involved in the administration and the health, and, they do dieting and all that sort of thing, so they're actually quite an integrated.
We've got a fair staff contingent of female employees as well in all those areas. Dietitian is we had a female doctor for last year. Women are very involved in our club, for sure, and Narelle's here today, actually, part of our sponsorship team. So, yeah, it's a part of the game that I know the Raiders are very fond in keeping that going.
I think the museum's actually hosting the Women in League dinner. Mm. So, it's been an issue which the museum's been interested in.
Well, the thing is with rugby league is they recognised a while ago that to broaden their supporter base, they needed to make sure that they treated women properly. And part of that was looking at all aspects of women being involved in rugby league. Primarily, 20 years ago, rugby league was dominated by men being on the board, men being in administration, sales, marketing, etc. Now, I think you'll find that a lot of clubs have got a lot of women involved in rugby league in the running of the game to ensure that they do appeal to women, because let's face it, if they stop appealing to women, that's half their supporter base gone.
And the catalogue for the exhibition, I should mention, we've asked to women journalists who covered rugby league for many years. Debbie Spillane and Tracy Holmes have written two of the chapters in the catalogue, which I think, you'd be interested in that, and you might want to look at those when they come out.
All right.
Tim, through you, we've been dealing rather at the elitist level of both codes at this stage. I wonder if each of the protagonists would like to comment on the real amateur area, the club football, the guys who play football just for the love of it, the country guys. Would you like to talk on those?
Well, definitely. Coming from a country background myself, I come from a town called Gundagai, and rugby league is Group 9, yes. Rugby league is Gundagai. Gundagai's rugby league. That's what they do. They train during the week. They play on the weekend. The whole town goes down to watch. It's a huge part of any sport, I suppose, grassroots level. I know in Canberra we've got a huge... The Canberra Raiders are actually owned by the Canberra District Junior Rugby League, which encompasses the Canberra Raiders Cup and all the junior level sport here. And for us, the Raiders in particular, see junior sport as a huge thing. And you'll notice that at our fan day next weekend, the first 2 hours of the day will be junior registration stalls will be set up before any of the first graders come in. We're going to be focusing on getting kids out here and signing up for sport. So it's something that we're really focused on, is getting people involved at the lower levels, not just getting them out to Canberra Stadium.
I'd like to take exception to Ben there, because I reckon that rugby league really is neglecting the bush at the moment. I come from Condobolin and Dubbo in central western New South Wales, and let me tell you, rugby league is struggling out there because the development offices that they used to have in those areas, they're not funding those offices anymore. It's very hard to get any support out there for rugby league. A lot of the money is being spent in the city areas. The country rugby league is now based in Sydney. It's very much Sydney, Brisbane, Canberra, not necessarily Canberra, but Sydney and Brisbane centric at the moment. And I think it's a real issue for rugby league. AFL is spending a lot of money in areas that have traditionally been rugby league centres, and I think that it's really time that the rugby league have a really close look at what is happening in the bush. I'm sure you'd agree with that, Ben. I mean, David Gallop has certainly said, listen, we've got to do more. Arthur Beetson, one of the greats of rugby league, has come out and said, well, listen, we're neglecting the bush. Our focus is very much too much on the NRL.
I suppose the ARL development team are a little bit stretched in that regard. They do have offices assigned for certain areas. We've got one here in Canberra. Brad Donald does a great job. They have them scattered out throughout country New South Wales. But it's a lot of factors to not only why rugby league's dying in the bush, it's sport in general. I suppose there's a changing face of culture, where all there was to do on a Sunday afternoon back in 1952 was to go down and watch the local rugby league or rugby union side play, where now they're competing for a lot of time and with other aspects of life, I suppose.
But part of the problem now is that you're taking the young, good young players straight out of the bush into the city. Mm. In the past, they used to be able to play in competitions like the AMCO Cup. Western Division won it 1 year against the big city sides. Now the young players, the young stars from the bush are going at 14, 15, 16 years of age, and it's really drying up a lot of talent in the bush, and the competitions are not as strong as they used to be.
Yeah, I know. It's a tough one, because teams at the elite level are competing to try and get the best players, and to get them, you have to get them at a young age, otherwise you won't get them, and it's just... It's a tough one. It's something that the NRL is going to have to look at, I suppose.
There's an object in the exhibition which captures this debate quite well, which is the Mar Cup, which in southern New South Wales was a really important country trophy and was incredibly popular from the 1920s through to the early 1970s, where country towns would stop to watch a Mar Cup match. But, of course, the sting in the tail is it did stop in the 1970s, and that people celebrate the Mar Cup, and there's a bunch of Tumut old boys who are coming down next weekend to celebrate, and sure, we'll celebrate long and hard. But it is true that it is 30 years since the Mar Cup was a force in rugby league.
All right, we've got some more questions.
I might just answer that on behalf of Rugby Union as well. Ben touched on the Brumbies dropping the ACT from the front of our title. That happened in 2005 when we also took on the far south coast and southern inland. So we dropped ACT because it wasn't reflective of the Brumbies rugby region. And since 2005, we've noticed that was an area that was really struggling. It was being neglected by New South Wales Rugby Union, so we've taken that on. We've got development offices in both the far south coast and southern inland, and since that time we've noticed growth in numbers in far south coast, southern inland, and also locally as well, particularly in junior numbers, and our senior club competition is a stable pool of players there.
The only thing about taking the ACT out of the Brumbies logo, I think it really disenfranchised a lot of people. Very proud of Canberra, and people thought, well, does this mean the team can go to Melbourne at any stage because you've taken the ACT out of the logo?
We're not going to Melbourne.
I know, but it's
we're
simply,
not going to Melbourne.
It simply created a lot of unrest and a lot of unease among supporters who had that in their mind, and it simply solidified that thought. And I thought that, gee, they probably could have done it better. That was my own personal point of view, taking the ACT straight out of the logo. It simply heightened people's fears to a certain extent.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. But as I said, it probably wasn't reflective of the Brumbies rugby region that we'd now taken on, as I said, the far south coast and southern inland that had been neglected for so long. And, you know, just a matter of including them as part of our brand as well.
Let me declare my interest. I never played good rugby union, but I played rugby union and managed first grade for 30 years. I then got in to Golden Oldies and managed to play till 55, 56, something like this. All my best friends came from rugby union teams that I played for. Now, in your talks, you talked about the crowds and whatever. You really said very little about the players. You said in rugby union all shapes and sizes. Ben, you really didn't mention the players and the players' enjoyment very much. Now, having said that, perhaps to address a comment to Tim, I have a son still in the UK who was playing for the local town fifth team. Even the town fifth team, I'm sorry, the town went professional. The first team players were paid £50 per game, 50 for a win, I think it was 25 for a draw. And I said to my lad, well, you're in the fifth team, how has it affected you? He said, training is shit. All we are now is cannon fodder for the guys being paid to play. So I said, what does it mean to you? He said, well, what it means is we don't go training anymore. We go 10-pin bowling. So we have the team spirit for the game, but we're not actually developing the skill set through training. Because if you're not a professional, if you're not in the first team, the coaches really aren't interested. And I see that as a huge, huge union problem.
Well, it's a problem in all sport, actually, at the moment. The win-at-all-costs attitude that has been brought in by professionalism and people are playing now for their livelihoods. I mean, before 1996, rugby union players weren't paid for their trade, and a lot of them had jobs, a lot of them went to university, as they do now, but you noticed almost immediately in 1996 the change in attitude from rugby union players. Suddenly it became their profession. Their whole outlook on the game changed. It was no longer a sense of enjoyment. You got the feeling that a lot more was riding on it. And it, certainly speaking to the players now, they talk about the fact they've only got a limited lifespan in the game, therefore they've got to take $700,000 a year in Japan. And to me, do you want to go and play in Japan or do you want to play in Australia? And the argument is always, well, I'd love to stay in Australia, but I can't afford to play here anymore. And to a certain extent, you have a look at the behaviour of a lot of sports people these days, and you have a look at the sportsmanship that sometimes is missing in sport, I put it down to the fact that there is so much money now available in sport, there's so much more riding on it. I'll talk about the fact that we're playing test cricket, but really you think to yourself, well, does that suddenly mean that you're going to drop standards in behaviour just because you're playing for a lot more and higher stakes? It's an issue that I could talk about for hours, but I won't. But I understand what you're talking about. As soon as they start paying players, it becomes a totally different kettle of fish.
Both of you mentioned superficially about what you do for young players. So could we hear from both about what you do for developing young players, not just as players but as contributors to society? And also we've heard about the golden oldies tradition with rugby union. What does league do for its ageing players? Is there a tradition? Is there a pathway for them? So if we just hear what you do for the developing young players and what you do for the oldie brigade, the retiring, do you have things in place to help them along the way?
As I mentioned before, the Toyota Cup, which is a new under-20s competition in the NRL's umbrella, I suppose, where it's now a national game. If the Raiders are playing the Storm, the under-20s will play the Storm. If the Raiders are playing the Warriors, the under-20s will go to New Zealand and play the Warriors as well. And part of the way that it's been set up is they've employed a full-time education and welfare officer for the Toyota Cup. All under-20s players are only allowed to train early in the mornings or late in the afternoons during the 8-hour, I suppose you call it the working day. They either have to undertake some form of study or go to employment. A lot of our players have trades. There's probably about half a dozen that are enrolled in university here in Canberra and study part-time there. So it's an area of the game that rugby league has picked up on a lot than what it did in the past. As far as the senior squad, again, a lot of those guys are doing things part-time to get not only get themselves away from football but prepare themselves for the future. I know that Alan Tung is studying to become a PE teacher at UC. William Zillman is doing a nutritionist course at UC, and Mark Herbert is doing sports media at UC, and that's just a few, to name a few. So there's definitely pathways there for the future, and I think our football manager now, David Sharp, is starting to implement a lot more Raiders-based programs in that area. As for the oldies, the NRL has a foundation called the Men of League Foundation where ex-players can become involved in rugby league, and they hold a number of charity events and things to raise money for local football clubs and for ex-players that may be doing it a bit tough. So that's a good way for that to come about as well.
And I can only sort of speak for what we're doing at the Brumbies, but in terms of junior player development, we've got, in terms of playing point of view, we've got a national talent squad, which is run by the Australian Rugby Union, but based at the Brumbies. I think each of the provinces have their own sort of wing of the national talent squad. We've also got a Brumbies Academy, which is basically an introduction into a professional program for these players. And then we've also got a full-time careers advisor at the Brumbies, and she assists them with tertiary studies or any other trades or anything like that they want to get involved in. So I would say at the moment the vast majority of players in our senior squad are all doing university courses, mainly by correspondence. And in terms of other skills, we also do things like media training with them as well, just in case that's something that they want to pursue after they finish their career.
You know, one of the real issues in this is, and I've spoken to many players about it, is that you've got a player on $230,000 a year. Suddenly he gets injured, he can't play anymore, or he's forced into retirement, and he's suddenly got to go into the workforce and finds out that most of Australia earns $90,000 a year or less than that. And they find it really hard to come to terms with, and that's why a lot of them keep trying to play till they're 35, 36 years of age. And it's a problem that exists in both rugby league and rugby union in trying to, I guess, ease footballers into the workforce. And I don't think that either code has successfully done it at this stage. It is a major issue.
It is hard. As I mentioned, there are some who do it a lot better than others. So as I mentioned, guys like Brett Robinson, he might be a bit of a different case because he had that. He sort of started in the amateur code and then came across in professionalism. But that sort of gets back to as well what we were saying, why players believe it's so important to make the most of this rugby window financially, which is why so many of them are being lured overseas because of the money that's being offered.
What about you, Ben? I mean, you've had issues with the Raiders where players have suddenly been cut from the club and they've had to find jobs and go into the workforce.
Yeah, I suppose at the end of last year we scrapped the Premier League from our club, which forced a number of players to leave. And we did our best to try and find them somewhere, to play football next year. And we've got a relationship with a club in Queensland, South Logan Magpies. And a lot of our former players that were taken out of our top squad are now playing up there and have been found jobs. I know Brad Cross, who played a few games of first grade last year, he's gone back to his trade of an electrician up there. So, I mean, we try and help him to an extent, but where do you draw the line on responsibility?
That's right, yeah. I mean, the here and now is what you're looking at, isn't it? I mean, if you suddenly had to take on the responsibilities of 40 ex-players as well as the 35 that you've got at the moment, it's almost a full-time job for 10 people, and you really can't afford that.
Yeah. I would like to give Ben credit for one of his points, just one, in his talk, and that was bringing up Tarman, the Waratahs' new mascot. I have absolutely no defence for that.
Mine's really a comment, or two comments. It's a long-time Canberra resident and also a dyed-in-the-wood rugby fan. I think the Raiders did a marvellous thing when they came to Canberra. Before they came, there was said to be no heart here. And they arrived on the scene, and even dyed-in-the-wool rugby people went along because they seemed to draw people in. They had good PR. And the reason they lost favour and the Brumbies came up was they started losing and the Brumbies started winning. And Canberra is notorious with only liking winners.
No.
Yes. the other thing is professional rugby has changed the whole thing. In the amateur days, you're talking about crowds. When I played with a winning premiership team in Sydney, we would have had 30 people there watching a game, and they were usually wives or sweethearts or some dyed-in-the-wool parent was coming along. We used to have at University Oval a man on the gate to collect money. Well, he never collected anything. And, we all just streamed in and out. And we had to do our own washing. We had our own supply our own jerseys. You had to get some friend to sew your number on the back. I mean, it's a totally different game now. And I don't think you can compare the old rugby to the present-day rugby because they're not the same. The two codes are very similar now.
I think both codes are competing commercially as well. They're out there in the market trying to get sponsorship for their teams and supporters as well to get people through the gate, to drive sponsorship, to pay the players the money. It's a vicious circle, and it happens in both codes. I agree.
On the point of the Raiders winning in winning the grand final and Canberra going lime green, I think that's one of the most positive things about rugby league is the transforming nature having a grand final winning side has on a community. And you go to the people at Campbelltown when West Tigers won, or you go to the people at Parramatta when the Eels won for the first time, or you go to the people at Penrith when Roy Simmons managed to score that try. Completely changed those communities, maybe only for a short while, but in some areas, which sometimes are a little bit run down and sometimes the self-respect might not be what it all should be, a victorious rugby league side can really pull a community together and give it a bit of backbone. And I think that's one of the most positive things that victorious rugby league sides have done in suburban communities around Australia.
Yeah, I reckon 1989 was possibly, in the last 30 years, the most positive thing that has happened in Canberra. Just the spirit that was generated, people started talking to each other. Suddenly people appeared on the streets. I mean, when I arrived in Canberra, 1988, you'd drive down the street on Sunday and be flat out seeing anybody for 30 miles. But you know, suddenly people started appearing on the streets, talking to each other, and just sheer celebration. It was quite remarkable. And And certainly a lot of the Sydney media who'd been bagging Canberra for many years suddenly said that Canberra had discovered its heart, and I thought that that was a real positive from sport, especially rugby league. And yes, the lime green in the fountain, Laurie Daly dropping the statue, I mean, it was just many, many aspects to it.
I think in Sydney, in the western suburbs, when Parramatta won its first grand final and Penrith won its first grand final, they really helped those communities, because those areas often get slagged off in the context of Sydney. So I think it was very positive.
Tell you what, in country towns, when the local rugby league side used to win, it was a galvanising thing. All the shops used to decorate
the windows. And,
yeah, decorate their windows. People would be putting stuff in their, the windows of their houses.
Yes, a couple of years ago in the rugby league.
Now, how are we going to decide this debate, do you think? Passing competition or...?
We've already established that there's more Brumbies fans here, so I don't like my chances.
What do you reckon? How about an arm wrestle?
Yeah, let these two guys have problems. Or get out of the way.
Oh, jeez, I don't know about that.
Are we arm wrestling?
We're going to arm wrestle, are we?
My Athia. Oh, well,
for the good of rugby league, and I know they need as much of a leg up as they can possibly get at the moment, particularly with their celebration, I'm happy to concede on this.
I'm happy to call it a draw, mate.
I was ready to commentate it too, because Ben in the left hand corner and the blue corner is 94 kilos and what are you, about 87, 88?
Close enough.
Yeah. We could, yes. An arithmetic test.
Just because spelling I went B. to a public school and worked for a rugby league club doesn't mean I can't spell, mate.
Can you please thank Ben Pollock, Nick Smith, Guy Hanson?
Just on behalf of the museum, I also would like to really thank the speakers who've given up their time to come in today. And next week, the exhibition will be open, and there's plenty in it for rugby union fans as well as for rugby league fans. And there's going to be a great day next Saturday with the Canberra Raiders Fan Day. And we're also holding the first Rugby League Film Festival. I believe it's the first time in the world. We'll be showing a series of Rugby League films during the exhibition on Sunday. So some great films, including some of you might remember the 1963 This Sporting Life with Richard Harris. We're going to get that out, as well as more contemporary Australian films like The Final Winter and Footy Legends. So some great films coming up and hopefully what will be a very popular exhibition. So thank you to everybody for coming today. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.